Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. The Big Myth is a nonfiction history and political analysis by Naomi Oreskes and Eric M. Conway that examines how free market ideology became a dominant American belief system. Rather than treating market fundamentalism as a natural outcome of economics, the book argues that it was built through a long campaign by business leaders, allied intellectuals, and media institutions to make government look suspicious and markets look self-correcting. The authors trace how this idea developed across the 20th century, moving from early anti-regulatory arguments to broader cultural and political influence. The book is not a technical economics text. It is an argument about persuasion, power, and the shaping of public common sense. Its purpose is to show how ideas about economic freedom were linked to political freedom, and how that linkage helped justify resistance to labor protections, consumer regulation, and social programs. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, how market fundamentalism turned a policy preference into a moral belief. A central insight of the book is that free market thinking became more than an economic argument. Oreskes and Conway show how it was framed as a moral and political principle, one that treated market freedom and personal liberty as inseparable. This move was important because it changed the terms of debate. Regulation was no longer just a tool to be evaluated on its merits, but a potential threat to freedom itself. By presenting government intervention as the first step toward tyranny, business advocates gave anti-regulatory politics a powerful emotional appeal. The book explains that this language was effective because it simplified complex social problems into a clear binary between freedom and control. That framing helped market fundamentalism spread beyond boardrooms and economics departments into broader public discourse, where it could be repeated by politicians, educators, and media voices as common sense. Secondly, business-led campaigns used schools, textbooks, and media to reshape public understanding. The book emphasizes that the rise of free market ideology depended on organized communication campaigns, not just abstract debate. Oreskes and Conway describe efforts to influence school textbooks, university curricula, popular culture, and broadcast media in order to normalize anti-government ideas. These campaigns mattered because they targeted institutions that produce public knowledge and legitimacy. If students encounter economic ideas only through materials shaped by corporate interests, those ideas can appear neutral and scholarly, even when they are politically loaded. The authors also show how media platforms helped spread the message to wider audiences, making the ideology more durable than a single election cycle or lobbying effort. This dimension of the book is important because it reveals a strategy of cultural saturation. The goal was not merely to win arguments in Washington, but to shape the background assumptions through which Americans would interpret markets, labor, and the role of the state. Thirdly, the book traces a long alliance between business elites and influential economists. Another major theme is the partnership between corporate interests and economists who supplied intellectual authority for market fundamentalism. The authors discuss how business leaders helped elevate figures associated with the Chicago School of Economics, especially Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, into national prominence. In the book's account, this was not just a matter of supporting scholarship. It was a way of giving ideological claims the status of expert knowledge. Economists provided language that could make deregulation and privatization sound principled, scientific, and inevitable. That alliance was effective because it connected money, academic prestige, and policy influence. The book suggests that once elite economic ideas are carried by respected universities and public intellectuals, they can travel far beyond the original business agenda. This helped convert narrow corporate interests into a broader ideology that appeared to speak for efficiency, rationality, and national prosperity rather than for business power alone. Fourthly, market freedom helped justify attacks on labor rights and social regulation. The historical examples in the book show that market fundamentalism was used to oppose concrete reforms, not just to defend an abstract philosophy. Oreskes and Conway describe campaigns against unions, child labor restrictions, workplace protections, and other forms of government oversight. These conflicts show how the ideology functioned in practice if markets are assumed to be naturally just and efficient. Then laws protecting workers or consumers can be recast as harmful interference. The authors make clear that this way of thinking helped delegitimize the idea of a common good that requires collective action. It also changed public expectations about what government should do. Instead of seeing regulation as a democratic response to market failures, many Americans came to see it as an intrusion. The book's analysis of these struggles is useful because it connects ideology to institutional outcomes, showing that ideas about free markets shaped real political battles over working conditions, public safety, and economic inequality. Lastly, the book links a century of anti-government rhetoric to modern crises. The authors do not stop at historical explanation. They argue that the victory of market fundamentalism helped create conditions for major contemporary problems, including the housing crisis, the opioid epidemic, climate damage, and weak public responses to COVID-19. Their point is not that one ideology caused every crisis in a simple way, but that decades of distrust toward government narrowed the range of acceptable policy responses. If the state is presumed to be ineffective or illegitimate, then regulation, public investment, and social protection become harder to defend even when evidence supports them. This gives the book contemporary relevance. It is a history of ideas with direct implications for public policy. At the same time, the authors argue for a middle path that is both pro-market and pro-government, suggesting that healthy capitalism depends on rules, institutions, and democratic oversight rather than on the fantasy of self-regulating markets. That balance is one of the book's most practical contributions. In conclusion, The Big Myth is best suited for readers interested in political history, economics, media influence, public policy, and the history of ideas. It will be especially valuable for those who want to understand why anti-government rhetoric remains so powerful in American life and how that rhetoric was built over time. Readers concerned with regulation, labor rights, climate policy, or the social role of business will find the book particularly relevant because it connects historical persuasion campaigns to present-day institutional failures. Its main benefit is analytical. It helps readers see market fundamentalism not as a neutral truth, but as a constructed ideology with identifiable promoters, channels, and consequences. Compared with many books on capitalism or conservatism, it stands out for its archival depth and its focus on persuasion across schools, media, academia, and corporate lobbying. It is less a general defense of regulation than a historical diagnosis of how public consent for deregulation was manufactured. That makes it distinctive, timely, and useful for readers seeking a serious account of how economic beliefs shape democracy. If you would like to support Naomi Oreskes, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.